Welcome to the 26th anniversary performance of A Sound of Lafferty. The talk and was originally presented to Critical Mass at a meeting in February 1989. It was published in November of that year in Australian Science Fiction Review second series. And I must thank Rip Baldridge and Ira M. Thornhill of Corroborate Press, because their remarks actually inspired the talk. They founded Corroborate Press in Minneapolis, Minnesota, to publish the work of R.A. Lafferty. Lafferty had said that any of his stories that weren't published at the time of his death were to be destroyed. So Corroborate Press was basically set up to publish as much of his material as they could before he died. At Ozicon 2, Rip mentioned that they used to proofread Lafferty aloud to each other and enjoyed it thoroughly. Now, looking back at his work, I realised also that the author is typically speaking directly to the reader. And that conversation triggered the thought that led to this. Let's start with a quote from Lafferty. "It's a secret river that not only greens the soul, but also runs under walls and gains entrance to all fortified and walled places of the world and of the mind. Regard your own estate and case. Is your own town not built on two rivers which are separated by a firmament between? One of them is the impossible river by which all things may enter anywhere. We'd be robbed of our celestial birthright without it." That's Ignace Wolff, The River Inside, quoted by R.A. Lafferty in Rivers of Damascus. Lafferty's words belong to such a river, an ancient, invisible river which nourishes and greens our imagination. The river made up of storytellers' voices, ancient and modern, weaving myth and legend, whispered ghost stories and telling folk tales, an oral tradition that stretches from cave mouth to radio studio, from the halls of Asgard to the main street of Lake Wobegon. R.A. Lafferty is not recognised as the brilliant fabulist he is because he belongs not to the literary tradition, but to the oral tradition. If his stories were recorded or broadcast on radio, he would have a huge following and would be kept constantly in print or on tape, or perhaps on podcast. Instead, he's appreciated by a select few, and most of his work is, alas, out of print. Because Lafferty follows the form, style, and content of the oral tradition, he's not appreciated in print. I suggest that his work is sadly undervalued and deserves to be reassessed. I contend that he's been neglected because of a literary bias towards the written word, and a proper appreciation requires placing his oeuvre in the appropriate context. Now you ask, why place Lafferty in the oral tradition? The first clue is the language. It rolls trippingly off the tongue. Sentences are short and straight. Reading a story aloud sounds right, and it's easy to do. The stories are often written in the first or second person, either narrated by one of the characters or directly by the author himself. Consider these passages from the start of one of his tales. "But here is the heroine, a live one, perhaps a lively one. Could she not be a platinum woman, scatter ornamented and beautiful according to the norms, or a shining ebony or a creamy chocolate? Should she not be adjusted and legal, flowery and scatter-eyed? Should she not be of the multiplexity, non-linear, a scan, an agape apple, a neutrino, a pop puppy, a poster coaster at the very least? Should she not be a happy medium, a plateau potato, a twanger, a mime, a dreamer, and enhancer dancer? Are these not the aspects of a heroine? Nah, she wasn't like that at all. She was a morning glory, which is illegal. She was a gown clown, which is also illegal. She was not flowery, not scatter-eyed. She wasn't even quite beautiful, though she rather wished that she were. And yet perhaps she was, in another way, in an old and almost private way. Here's the hero. Should he not be a swing, a slant, a cut, according to the norms? A spade, a buck, a wanger? Should he not be a head, a flash, an etch, a neutrino yet, a burn, a vein, a flower? Yeah, but he wasn't like that. He wasn't that kind of hero at all. He was a dawner. He was a doggedly pleasant man. He was even a sort of battler. He saith among the trumpets, ha ha, and he smelleth the battle far off, Job. He was friendly. He was even intelligent on some subjects and murderous on others. He was big enough and thick enough. His hair was brambled but short. The people said he would be the father of Ishmael. He didn't know what they meant. Neither did the people. He was a moving man with cat springs in him. He was a yellow-card street sweeper. And his name was Morgan Saunders. He was making his rounds, cleaning up after the swingers. He growled when he came to the twisted and grubby woman, who was very young and very dead." That's from Ishmael into the Barrens, Golden Gate and other stories. Next, observe that Lafferty follows the form of folk tales with their design for the listener, not the reader. The story, as well as the language, is linear. We don't have complex flashbacks, multiple viewpoints, and convoluted conversations. We do have asides to the listener, reminders of other events in a larger cycle of tales, and the repetition of detail that are common to stories told. We also have the repetition traditional to folk tales, the structure which allows for anticipation on the part of the listener, i.e. three little pigs, three brothers, four tasks, and so on. Consider these two passages from Days of Grass, Days of Straw. Christopher Fox was walking down a city street. No, it was a city road. It was really a city trail or path. He was walking in a fog, but the fog wasn't in the air or the ambient. It was in his head. Things were mighty odd here. There was just a little bit of something wrong about things. Christopher Fox was walking down a city street. Things were mighty even here, mighty neat. There was just a little bit of something wrong about their rightness. The world was rubbed, scrubbed, and tubbed. It was shaved, paved, and shaved. It was neat, sweet, and effete. Or how about this extract from Brain Fever Season in Ringing Changes, as Barnaby Sheen and colleagues are trying to find out why one of the hottest new items in the porno stores is an 1834 grammar of the Tibetan language. Naturally, Sheen suspects his Australopithecine houseboy, Ostro. Ostro, do you know why an obscure Tibetan grammar should suddenly become a hot item in the porno stores? Mr. Sheen, you know I'm not old enough to go into the porno stores. No, but you're old enough to avoid a direct answer to a straight question. Ostro, if this little puzzler were handed to you, what first step would you take toward finding an answer? Carrick, I'd triangulate in on it. I'd find where the puzzle originated and where it spread from. Oh, why don't I learn to swallow my tongue? Why do you ask me questions? I'm just a 12-year-old kid. Got to go right now. And Ostro ran down the stairs and out of the house. Barnaby Sheen phoned Roy Megger at his mysterious number at his mysterious room. Nobody was sure where Roy Megger lived, but Barnaby Sheen believed the young man had a room in that very house. Barnaby's was a big and junky house. Most persons know how many rooms there are in their houses and where they are, but not Barnaby. And Roy had a cavalier way with space and with telephones. Barnaby was sure that he was paying the phone bill on Roy's mysterious phone, at least. Roy, Barnaby barked into the phone. Do you know why an obscure Tibetan grammar should suddenly become a hot item in the porno stores? Do you believe me the sort of young man who goes into porno stores? Roy's voice asked out of the phone. I'm hurt. Besides, it isn't obscure any longer. Got to hang up now. Got to go down to the lab and work on a hot new idea. Roy, if you were asked to solve the problem of Tibetan grammars suddenly becoming hot items in porno stores all over the world, where would you start? I'd start the same place as any other problem. I'd find out where it starts. Then it's easier to find out what it means. I'd triangulate in on it and find out who created the situation and started the problems rolling around the world. Oh, I've got to invent an automatic guardian for myself. We hadn't decided what we wanted to do with it yet. Why do I say these things? Got to go now. Got to go down to the lab for one of those brilliant sessions. You see the repetition there as well. Many stories have an explicit prologue in which the characters are introduced, the action foretold. Not always in all detail, sometimes teasingly. Such presage is typical of folklore or theatre. Warnings occur early in the story. Beware of the big bad wolf. Chants and verses warn of events to come, or cycles of events which repeat themselves. The world in Lafferty is constantly remade. Patterns of events reoccur. And what about the stories themselves? Lafferty's stories typically deal with mythic heroes, mythic themes. We hear of long-forgotten times, mighty deeds, and forgotten heroes. Lafferty tells us of a rougher world, a livelier place, with characters painted in bold colours, not all of them visible to the human eye. This mythopoeic style is not in vogue. The magic realism of Borges, Fuentes, and Marquez has only recently, that would be in the 70s when this was first written, enlarged the popular market. SF remains firmly wedded to the naturalistic style of the 30s, with thankfully a few exceptions, and fantasies trapped in an endless series of barbarians, wizards, and quests, or a naturalistic style slightly extended, One Ordinary Day with unicorns. Cyberpunk moves further into the realm of gritty realism, and to cover such themes in a humorous and witty manner, very Irish, but not in vogue in the genre, much less in vogue back in 1989 when this was published. Perhaps the closest genre worker was Cordwainer Smith, equally poetic but far more serious, and his universe didn't shift as much as Lafferty's. What makes up Lafferty's world? The R.A. Lafferty universe has more in common with that of the 12th century, Before the scientific worldview, when all manner of beings and objects were endowed with life and intelligence, when secrets were all about, waiting to be discovered. Many of his characters possess abilities beyond ours. They have extra or sharper senses. They have multiple personalities. They know of multiple events. They have tricks and skills which are rarely explained but taken for granted. Bilocation is such a handy skill. R.A. Lafferty's characters inhabit a wider, richer, more densely populated world. Consider the beings which populate Lafferty's stories. Many are of the first race, the one with six fingers, or the demigods fashioned of clay, or Australopithecus. Some are the essence of character, such as the detective or the master forger. Archetypes? No, the archetypes are based on these characters. Some have ancient histories. All are extraordinary. Lafferty doesn't pretend these are normal people. They just are and inhabit the world. And of course, there are many tales. It's taken for granted that there are multiple histories of the world. Or perhaps the world is born eternally anew, and events are foretold to recur again and again. We're never sure if the current version is real or imagined or stable for the length of the story. In Apocalypses, we have the curious tale of an extraordinary forgery. Listen as our master detective, Constantine Quiche, consults the world's greatest forger, Angelo de Cyan. How big, Angelo? That's my first question. How big a forgery could there be? Oh, as big as the biggest figure that could be written on the biggest tab that the customer could lift. There is no other limit. I could forge this very world that we're on, and I could forge it convincingly enough for your most astute planet buyer. All I would need is money enough for the project and a place to set my fulcrum. Yes, all right, Constantine said. I didn't know it could be done quite that big, and this isn't a question of it. As big as a county or a realm, yes, but not as big as a world. Then there is the other part of the inquiry. How about a forgery? How shall I say this? A forgery of which there is no original. Oh, certainly, certainly. There are instances of that, Constantine. That is almost too easy sometimes. To do it best, one has to reject the too easy and too cheap solutions. Then you have really quality forgeries of which there are no material originals. This thing is difficult only because it places the forger on his honour, or at least on that forgery that he may delegate to serve as his honour. It's so hard to check it when there's nothing to check it by, and the commissioning of such a thing might be subject to abuse. And there's another detail which not quite master forgers sometimes overlook in doing forgeries without originals. There is one small thing that must be done. One must make a slight change in the world first, a silent, slight, adaptive change in the world itself, so as to produce such a world as would accommodate this missing masterpiece. But we all of us change the world continually. Nor let us be misled by such a term as missing original. That's not the same thing as no original. I have in mind one of my own nearly perfect forgeries, the Weeping Hermes of Praxiteles. I made this forgery of an unavailable original. I made it very much as Praxiteles would have made it, and I made it as good as Praxiteles could have made it. The original had been the landmark Greek sculpture of the 4th century BC, and I made it be so. But I had already rambled through the mind of Praxiteles by means of many of his other sculptures, which is what made my forgery without an original such a superior one. But it wasn't as if there had never been an original. There had been. I could study the missing masterpiece by its effect on all later works. I could study the written descriptions of it that have come down to us. Really, I already had the impression, as it were, from the mud in which it had lain. I had only to pour the mud mould full of molten marble. Incidentally, I found the missing Praxiteles, the Weeping Hermes itself, and I'm ruddy foxed if I know what to do with it. It isn't as good as my version, which is now accepted as the original. Even as one of my authentic forgeries, it would lower my reputation a bit. But I'll keep it a while, then I'll find a way to turn it to best advantage. But you're talking about the forgery of something that never was, and yet could have been? Yes, I am, Angelo, Constantine said. And perhaps that could have been context would have to be, maybe has already had to be, forged also. Oh, well, many things are able to grow their own context about them. Sometimes a thing will seem right for a while, and then it will seem just a little bit wrong. Like yourself.
Like myself, Angelo?
Yes. Weren't you absolutely secure and sure of yourself as the best detective in the world for a while? And in the last 18 hours or so, haven't you come to feel that there was something just a little bit wrong with you in that role? With you in any role?
Yes, that's so, Angelo. What of it?
Maybe you here present are only a forgery of Constantine Quiche. Maybe I forged you. Oh, well, at least Quiche would have then been a masterly forgery. Somehow this passage always reminds me of Wells's F for Fake. Lafferty's work belongs firmly to the tradition of folk tales and myths,
Many of his stories not only deal with the traditional themes, complete with morals, but they fall naturally into a cycle of tales. Let's consider some of Lafferty's works. Archipelago and Finnegan. What could be more Irish than tales of Finnegan and the Devil? Their story is told in a trilogy of novels, Archipelago, The Devil is Dead, and More Than Melchizedek. Only the middle one of these has wide circulation. Dobson, SF 71. The first was published in 1979 by a small press manuscript. Until recently, the third was unpublished. From the Primanti of The Devil is Dead. And they also tell the story of Papadopoulos, the devil, and his company, and of two of the hidden lives of Finnegan, and how it is not always serious to die the first time it happens. Here is one man who was buried twice and now lies still, but uneasy of mind, in his two separate graves. Here is another man who died twice, not at all the same thing. And here are several who are disinclined to stay dead. They don't like it. They won't accept it. Given here for the first time anywhere are the bearings and correct location of the terrestrial paradise down to the last second of longitude. You may follow them. You may go there. Here will also be found the full account of where the devil himself is buried, and surprising name that is on his tombstones, boldly spelled out, and much else. The Men Who Know Everything. Barnaby has a curious collection of folks at his place. There's Ostro, the houseboy and bartender of Barnaby Sheen, who is one of the genus Australopithecus, which is either ape or ape man or man, the middle one of these being impossible. The genus was supposed to be extinct long ago, but Ostro was proof that it wasn't. Loretta Sheen was a life-size sawdust-filled doll. Barnaby insisted that this object was the undead body of his real daughter Loretta. We had all known Barnaby well all our lives, yet we couldn't remember for sure whether he had ever had a real daughter or not. Mary Mondo was a ghost, the schizo personality of a girl named Violet Lonsdale, who was long since dead. But Mary Mondo was not dead. That's Animal Fair through Elegant Eyes. Roy Megger, as we saw earlier, may also be one of Barnaby's guests. We don't quite know. Ostro, incidentally, also produces a curious yet popular, at times prophetic, comic strip, Chiseled into Stone. Barnaby Sheen and his friends, the Men Who Know Everything, Dr. George Dracos, Harry O'Donovan, Chris Benedetti, and R.A. Lafferty, who admits his lack of knowledge in some areas is somehow overlooked by his companions, keep inventing things and getting into trouble. The stories appeared in the 70s and are collected in Through Elegant Eyes from Corroboree Press in 1983, and also some in Ringing Changes from Ace in 1984. The Institute of Impure Science. The Institute and its members appear in a wondrous novel, Arrive at Easterwine, the autobiography of a artistic machine. Since the entire story is told by the machine, we're never sure if the shifting events and constant changes in history actually happen, are a delusion of machines, or are enacted in some simulation of a parallel world within the machine. Many abstract qualities become measurable from Arrival at Easter One. This extension of the EP locator will locate habitats of love and benignity without fully understanding what they consist of. The device scans and ultimately records in itself all human locations in the world where authentic benignity and love obtain. I have most of them now. I have them all, unless unsuspected ones should turn up in supposedly unpopulated wastes of Antarctica. And these loci that I have do not add up to very many. Only 7 towns in the world, each of less than 1,000 persons, no more than 100 hamlets, not over 500,000 families, and about as many singletons. We will discover, if we may, just what is to be found in these special loci, Aloysius said, and then we will imitate the special thing in our own persons to the extent that we are adequate persons to compass it. What we will do, said Gregory, is extract the special essence that is to be found in these places. Then we'll put it through every test possible, inside and outside of a pict. When we have it analysed completely, we'll synthesise it. We are now able to synthesise anything we can analyse. And when we've synthesised, then we'll manufacture it on a large scale and we'll spew it out into the world in overpowering quantities. By this, we will change the world, as nobody has known how to change the world before. Ah, oh, coot's food, it won't work, Aloysius said. There's a barrier between such things and others. You yourself, Aloysius, have in other experiments shown the barrier between tangibles and intangibles to be a semi-permeable membrane, Gregory Smirnoff stated. Glasser has proved emotion to be an electromagnetic phenomenon. Valerie has shown group feeling to be a chemical affinity. Cogsworth has measured the velocity vector of several of the intuitions. You yourself have demonstrated that grace has both weight and valence. I've done valuable work on the in-grace and out-of-grace isotopes of several substances, proving the materiality of grace. Everything is a material base. There is nothing the matter with matter. Life is no more than a privileged form of matter. Love is no more than a privileged form of life. It is an all one stream flowing along forever. If we did not believe this, we would be false to the very idea of the Institute of Impure Science. Well, Lafferty's themes and concerns are those you'd expect from a mythmaker. His Roman Catholic background permeates his work, imbuing his stories with fantastic characters. Themes include the discovery of ancient magic, the creation of the world and its inhabitants, hidden, ancient and forgotten knowledge, the eternal struggle between good and evil. Now, I wonder here if Lafferty is guilty of the Nestorian or Albigensian heresy. At the very least, he would be sympathetic to the view of the Bogomils that the devil created the world. But that's another discussion for that way madness for a PhD thesis lies. For all the reasons suggested above, Lafferty's stories are tales to be told and retold. They're designed to be read aloud and enjoyed. Lafferty is an extraordinary fabulist and mythmaker. He deserves to be as famous as Cordwainer Smith, but isn't treated seriously because of the humour in his tales. Also, the former's work doesn't suit the written word. He's continuing the oral tradition in a modern setting. If it weren't for our bias towards the written form and naturalistic narrative, he would be recognised for the Irish-American genius he is. There are hundreds of tales as yet unpublished, but unlike Philip K. Dick, his genius won't suddenly be discovered after he dies. His agent has orders to destroy any unpublished stories. Hence the project for Corroboree Press. Finally, you might want to put Lafferty to the acid test. Find a friend and read them some stories aloud. Treat them to the sound of Lafferty.